From the newsrooms of the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, this is The Televisionaries. Hello! Today we're going on the run with the best-dressed psychopathic serial killer on TV, looking at whether TV has achieved gender equality, and would you believe we're on the case with Maxwell Smart and Agent 99. I'm Louise Rugendyke, and welcome to The Televisionaries. Here with me today are my fellow secret operatives from the Herald and the Age newsrooms. We have Spectrum Deputy Editor Kylie Northover, and calling in from our LA studio is our Culture Editor-at-Large Michael Erdardo. Hello.
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 How are you both?
Good, really good.
Good.
Today we're looking at the smart and sexy black comedy thriller Killing Eve. Based on the Villanelle novels by Luke Jennings, it's a delicious cat-and-mouse game between British Intelligence Services agent Eve Pilastri, played by Sandra Oh, and the psychopathic but incredibly stylish Russian assassin-for-hire Villanelle, played by Jodie Comer. Across the first two seasons, their obsession with each other grew as they chased each other across England and Europe. Eve was on the hunt for a mysterious female assassin, while Villanelle took great and creative delight in the pile of bodies she left in her wake. It's violent, very funny, and unlike any spy series before it. Season 1 was created and written by TV's current It Girl, Phoebe Waller-Bridge, who wrote and starred in the incredible series Fleabag, and who was also recently hired to polish up the script for the new James Bond film. For Season 2, she handed writing duties to Call the Midwife actor Emerald Fennell, and now for Season 3, the writer is Suzanne Heathcote, who has worked on Walking Dead prequel Fear the Walking Dead. Season 3 starts this week on the ABC. Before we jump into it, let's have a listen to this clip where Sandra Oh's Eve is talking to her former MI6 colleague Kenny, played by Sean Delaney.
I went to see you after they transported you from the hospital in Rome.
Really?
But they weren't allowing visitors and I felt a bit... Lucky those tourists found you when they did. You missing MI6?
Absolutely not. How is it?
I've no idea. I quit.
Okay. So, Kylie, it's been said Villanelle offers a window into a life most women never get the chance to lead, a life defined by female desire, rage unfettered by financial worries or domestic obligations. Does that apply to you?
Oh, look, I'm not sure I envy everything about her, but certainly her Paris apartment and her wardrobe. But I absolutely love this show, even though perhaps series two was a little bit more of the same. But series one was just, it's amazing. It's the complete gender flip of your traditional cat and mouse spy caper. Everyone's a woman. The boss is a woman, Fiona Shaw, who's amazing. Villanelle, obviously. And then Eve, all women. And it often seems that there's a lot of men are obviously the victims, which is quite good, quite a nice turn of events. And even Eve's long-suffering husband, Nico, he was a bit wet and a bit simpering, wasn't he?
He was
the traditional wife figure, sort of nagging from the kitchen. And I mean, even though I quite like him, I like the whole gender flip all the way through it. It was quite good. Mm. And obviously I love her fashion and it sort of plays into her being just a complete narcissistic psychopath as well.
Yeah. Michael, do you think Killing Eve is still hitting its target?
I loved the first season. Mm. Phoebe Waller-Bridge is an amazing writer and I don't really think everything in television should sort of boil down to a kind of Phoebe Waller-Bridge is amazing and everyone else is terrible kind of discussion. But I do think, I have to say, season two wasn't as great as season one and season three really fell short for me. I've kind of landed in it. I'm a bit like, are we here still? Is this all still the same? Is the dynamic still unchanged? Even James Bond movies give you a new villain every movie. And I kind of feel like it's not a romantic will they or won't they, but I think the mechanics aren't that different. I feel like if you're watching a show like, you know, Moonlighting really struggled to navigate the should they or shouldn't they. And a nemesis relationship is a dysfunctional relationship in the same way that a TV romantic relationship is kind of comically dysfunctional, and managing the balance of that without the narrative kind of falling over is a real challenge. And I think what Phoebe Waller-Bridge does is she's a really inventive writer. She is a very original and a really fresh seeming writer. The writer, you really often feel like you're watching something that you haven't seen before, even though in real terms you kind of probably have. But season three, it's thin for me. I feel like I landed in it, and I feel like I'm struggling to fire up with love for it.
There's not much we can actually say for people who haven't seen the first episode because there are a lot of spoilers. But I did get the feeling that perhaps they had realised they need to take the narrative in a slightly different direction.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. The New York Times did a good profile on it a couple of months ago where they talked about how they're deepening the backgrounds of both the characters. We get a little bit more motivation for both of them. And look, what I've really enjoyed about it is just that Villanelle as a villain, just the fact that she takes such delight in what she's doing, that's not something that you sort of see. It does come from a sadistic place, but it doesn't feel like sort of sex-based motivation that so many crime shows have, you know, where it is constantly, as we're saying, you know, the woman victim, raped, murdered, blah, 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 blah.
Yes.
You know, this is Villanelle, yeah, taking pure delight, you know, in her job. She's a woman who enjoys her job, and I think that's always worth watching. Depending, doesn't matter what they're doing, whether it's Peggy Olson in Mad Men writing great advertising copy or if it's Villanelle sticking a pin in someone's eye. I'm here for it. And doing it while she's wearing a fantastic sort of, you know, pink suit or whatever.
Oh, the fashion is extraordinary.
Vogue have already got an article up already for season three, so they're in it.
Of course.
Michael?
My struggle with it is I feel like every season a show narratively should reset.
Yep.
And I think, you know, in a sitcom that sort of resets to a really sort of to kind of a position one. And with a narrative drama like this, you're not meant to go back to position one, but you are expected to kind of push the story forward. And I think my battle with this show is that I feel like the second season I came back and I didn't really feel like we were propelled too far forward. And the third season,
yeah.
I'm wanting to push forward and I'm feeling like I'm kind of getting resistance from the show.
So do you want Eve to go on the run with Villanelle? What are you looking for?
No, I'm just looking for I just need the story to reset. I feel like if it's just this, I feel like it starts to wear thin. If it's just a nemesis relationship, you know, even, you know, Sherlock wasn't just Sherlock and Moriarty. I don't think the nemesis relationship alone is enough to sustain the narrative.
Mm.
This is a rock solid show. I just think that for season three, I need a little bit more, I don't know, I need a bit more some fire in the engine. I'm just not, I feel like it's at a crossroads and it's not getting me where I want to go. So if I have to say yes or no, I'll probably say no.
How many episodes do you give something before you drop out? Are you someone who
I think to
in
be
the
fair, well, to be fair, I think broadly here, to be fair, I'm up to the first episode of the third season.
Yeah.
So it's not like I've not invested my time. But I think to be fair, I mean, I'm not a great believer in that argument when people launch shows and go, oh, you've got to wait till episode five. It gets really good in episode five. I'm a bit like, look, it's a television series. You do have to hit your stride coming out of the gate. And there are enough brilliant pilot episodes in the history of television to teach us that you can get it right on the first episode. And I think that saying that you somehow couldn't get it right till episode five is a bit of a cop-out. But I think to be fair with a TV show, you probably should give it a couple of episodes. But I think the onus is on any TV show to pretty much sell it to you in episode one.
Oh, fair enough. Kylie, you in, you out?
Oh, I'm totally in. Even if just for the production design and the costumes. It's all completely implausible, but it's just so beautifully done. And I still think the writing is sharp and I'm intrigued to see where it goes.
Yeah, same with me. The first episode of season three had me hooked enough to want to watch the next ones. And I agree with you, the production design, especially in the first episode, the season three opener of the wedding in Spain is just
amazing.
Gorgeous. Okay, speaking of cat and mouse games, for this week's Game Time, we've got a new one. This week's Game Time, we're going to play Credit Where Credit's Due, where I read out the first few lines of the prologue or theme song, typically from the opening credits of a show, and you have to guess where it's from. So it's first in best dressed. Michael, buzzer.
I'll go buzz.
Bzz, Kylie, what are you going to?
Honk.
Honk it is.
This is an easy one to start off with. In the criminal justice system.
Honk. People,
oh, this is easy. Bzz, oh,
I think Kylie got it. Kylie, yes.
She did.
Very
oh
good.
My God.
Very good.
Yeah.
That is actually voiced by a former politician, politician. Yeah.
Oh.
Stephen Zern-Kilton. There we go. Theme song too. Bad Boys, What You Want, What You Want, What You Gonna Do When Sheriff John Brown Come For You.
I know this. Oh, God.
Honk, it's not Cops.
Yes.
Oh.
Do we want a small bit of information about Cops? It started because of a writer's strike. They were after some cheap TV, unscripted television.
Course.
Cops was born. There we go.
Oh.
Massive show. Massive, massive show.
Number three. Well, you woke up this morning, got yourself a gun. Your mama always said you'd be the chosen one. She said, you're one in a million. You've got to burn to shine, but you were born under a bad sign with a blue moon in your eyes.
Oh, God, I've got no idea. No, I'm out.
It's not Sopranos.
Yes.
Oh.
Oh, it is.
Yeah, on fire today.
Only got that from the very first line. Yeah, right.
That's done by the Alabama Three. All right. I think we're going to give that well and truly to Kylie. Michael, up your game for the second round. Our big question today is if gender equality has improved on TV. As we've just discussed, shows such as Killing Eve, with its female creators, writers, and female dominant cast, is just one of a group of high-profile shows that's championing women's voices, not just on screen, but behind the screen as well. Other shows include Insecure, The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, Russian Doll, Broad City, and basically anything by Grey's Anatomy powerhouse Shonda Rhimes and 30 Rock's Tina Fey. Meanwhile, in Australia, Screen Australia has started linking funding to the number of creative roles occupied by women. So, are things really changing, or is this just a few high-profile names masking the status quo? Are we really just looking at stories written by and for men? Michael, what do you think?
Well, I would say that it's probably a twofold thing, which is the amazing news is that in the here and now, things have improved dramatically. So if you look at kind of the last kind of big bunch of crunchy numbers, they said about 43 of the top 100 films had a female lead or a co-lead, and television, weirdly, and film were roughly on par as of about 2019. So you're looking at about 43% of stuff has a female lead or a co-lead. I still think the flip side of that is it's still really not great, because actually if you kind of drill into it, the number of, you know, out of that 100 films, for example, only three of the female leads or co-leads were over 45. You know, only 16 of them were from underrepresented ethnic groups. So in a funny way, there's still huge chunks of the population that are invisible on TV culture. And the other thing I think behind the scenes is much slower to come to the party. They say about 15% of directors are women, about 17% of writers, and about 18% of studio commissioning executives. Those are still really, really small numbers, and I think the result is that you still have a lot of white men in charge of kind of create the creative decision-making process, and I think the net effect of that is that you still have a lot of kind of undiverse stuff coming through. Now, that said, there are some great initiatives. Producers like Ryan Murphy have programs where they basically say that the show must have 50% female directors and that the writers' rooms must be either gender equal or ethnically and gender accurate. So if it's a story about women, the writer's room needs to be dominantly women in order to achieve that. And there was a great quote I read last week in relation to Party of Five. It was the producer of the reboot of Party of Five essentially saying that what she discovered was she created Party of Five, the original Party of Five. And in the new version of that show, it's an ethnically different story. It's about a Mexican-American family dealing with losing parents to America's kind of draconian border laws. And what she discovered was, she said, until she actually had people sitting in the writer's room who had lived that experience, she really didn't realize until then how much deeper their understanding of it was. So there is a real importance around getting these representational numbers right, because I think they bring a truth to storytelling that I think we all yearn for.
Yeah. Kylie, does it matter to you if a story is written by a man or a woman? I mean, as long as it's good, does it matter?
I mean, it doesn't matter. I mean, that plays into a lot of the things that's happening in literature, isn't it, about can you write about something you don't know about?
Yes.
I also worry with these quotas that they're doing, is that just going to be, you know, like affirmative action style? Is that just all a bit token?
So you mean programs like Screen Australia's Gender Matters program, which increases representation for women in female storytelling roles? Do you not think that works?
I believe that started in about 2015 or so. And it's great, but it's obviously, as I was saying, it's a bit sad that we need it. So that was to address the underrepresentation of women in the roles of sort of writers, producers, directors, right across. I think it's mainly film. But if it's going to produce new writers and new women's stories, then, you know, it's great.
I think streaming services are opening a really good window for a lot of female creatives. Like Netflix have given Shonda Rhimes like sort of between $100 million, $150 million to launch a whole bunch of her shows. I know she had a long run on, was it CBS? That's where Grey's Anatomy and all those are, wasn't it, Michael?
ABC. Grey's is on ABC. But even on a network, Shonda's a really good example of somebody who not only ran really good female-led shows and female-led writers' rooms, but she's also told great women's stories. She's. I mean, essentially, we credit her with finding, just to bring it back to Killing Eve. I mean, you know, Grey's Anatomy discovered, certainly to me, I didn't know Sandra Oh before Grey's, and I thought she was one of the best things in Grey's. I mean, Sandra Oh's a gift to us as an actress. And so I feel like Shonda has been amazing about not just telling women's stories, but also telling diverse stories. The fact that in the hands of any other producer, the Sandra Oh discovery in Grey's might have been like, you know, a pretty blonde girl from the Midwest. But in fact, Shonda is able to see past that and is able to cast the incredibly talented Asian girl in the room who 10 years ago or 20 years ago, casting directors would have paused over, which is just, I mean, it does your brain in. But actually, I think even on network television, which we would argue is probably the slowest to modernise, Shonda Rhimes has done extraordinary stuff.
But the problem, I think the problem is too, though, the pay is not keeping up. Because if you look at their list of top 10 paid TV actors, like in the US, I think it was like last year, 8 out of 10 were all male leads. And they're all on the Big Bang Theory too, which is kind of mind-boggling to me. Jim Parsons is like the most well-paid person on a US TV. It's like something like $26.5 million an episode. Oh, no, yes.
For the final season, they're on substantially less than season one. But yes, of course.
Yeah, but I think the best paid female was another one, the Big Bang Theory women. But after that, it was Ellen Pompeo from Grey's Anatomy, who I think got like number 8, and then Ed O'Neill from Modern Family at number 10.
The challenge, I think, is, and this is probably as true for Australia as anywhere else, which is, I mean, they call it the Equal Pay Act, but there is legislation that sort of tries to take those steps. But the problem with, of course, show business is things are so arbitrary. Now, take the case of Modern Family. Is Ed O'Neill the most valuable player on the team? Possibly not in the 11-year play out of the show, but certainly when the show began, he was the most famous bankable comedy actor that the show signed. So logically, he was number one on the call sheet, and he was therefore the highest paid person on the show. This sort of comes up a little bit in Hollywood where someone will say, oh, they don't pay enough, or they underpay. I was underpaid, or that actor was underpaid. The truth is, on every television show, there's a call sheet. Every actor is ranked by number in order of their importance on the show, and very often they are paid in a similar way. For number six on the call sheet to say, I'm not being paid enough because I'm a woman and that guy's getting more than me. Well, if he's number one on the call sheet, the hierarchy of production has dictated that it doesn't matter whether he is a guy or a piece of cheese or a shoe, he's going to get paid more than everybody in the room. Mm. So there's some arbitrary economics in show business based around who's the most famous, who's going to bring the biggest audience, who's the most bankable, who's driving the commerce of the show.
Yeah, but I suppose that if women are being given the chance to lead a show, then they'll never be number one on the call sheet, will they?
It's a circular argument. Until you give women the opportunity to take the lead part, they can't become bankable.
Yeah.
So in a way, we do have to suck it up. We do have to basically take gambles. We have to put women in the centre of the piece, and we have to let them build their bankability. Look at Wonder Woman. You know, the last 5 years theatrically in cinemas, you know, I feel like Superman and Batman fell over, and Wonder Woman and Aquaman were the superstars. Aquaman, who's like the DC hero that everyone thinks is a dud, and Wonder Woman is like the first female-led, proper big-budget, you know, super-duper comic book movie, and it made a squillion. And the lesson is that it's an illusion that people don't want to go and see those things. It's kind of this myth that people won't bank on women, or that audiences won't want to watch a show led by women. And the truth is, the lived experience is, the opposite is almost always the truth.
Certainly for me, when I'm watching TV, I do look for more, I suppose, female shows that got more of a female production background to them, and I'll sort of gravitate towards that. And what the best thing about sort of, I suppose, female-run TV is that it opens the door to other creatives. Like, for example, Phoebe Waller-Bridge worked with her co-writer Vicky Jones on Fleabag, the stage show, and Vicky Jones is now, her new show, Run, is just starting on Foxtel this month. So I probably wouldn't have just thought about that if I hadn't found out about Vicky through Phoebe Waller-Bridge. So it's just more, it's basically women lifting up other women, you know, in creative roles, and I think that's a good thing. Right, let's move on to our back catalogue show for the day. As I mentioned, when talking about Killing Eve, Phoebe Waller-Bridge was recruited to work on the new James Bond film. And in a very neat segue, our back catalogue show today was originally conceived as a James Bond spoof, although you could say Roger Moore already took care of that. Anyway, so starring Don Adams as the bumbling Agent 86 and Barbara Feldman as the more sensible Agent 99, it is Get Smart. The spy satire, the gift of the world gadgets such as the shoe phone, the cone of silence, knockout lipstick, and Jaime the robot. It was co-created by Mel Brooks, and its reruns were a staple of afternoon TV in Australia for years. Kylie, Get Smart was your pick. What do you love about it?
I actually went back and rewatched some of it, and I think it still holds up as well. Mm. It's just classic sort of satire, I suppose. I think it also became much more sort of a character-driven thing, where it became a lot about the in-jokes and the different characters, and as much as the bumbling sort of spy storyline. It's also memorable, all the props, all the characters, and it's still really, really funny.
Yeah, and the theme song still sticks in your head too. Like, even as soon as we started talking about this, I just had the doors shutting as you kept going closer and closer into the nose. Look, Michael, before we get you to have a chat about it, let's have a listen to this clip from Get Smart.
Bravo, magnificent!
You like that, Mr. Wilcox? Are you certain you're a music lover?
Well, of course I am. Well, do you know that I once listened to 3 straight weeks of Beethoven? Would you believe it? 3 weeks of Beethoven.
I find that hard to believe.
Would you believe 2 weeks of Bach?
I don't think so.
How about an hour of Looney Tunes?
Michael, does it hold up for you?
Of course it does. This is a masterpiece. This is one of those shows that I think, by virtue of the high repeat cycle, it does live in American culture, but it's maybe a little bit bigger or special to Australia. I feel like it was just on after school every day of my school life. Don Adams is amazing. Barbara Feldon is amazing. As Kylie was saying, it really lives in the supporting players. I loved, you know, Jaime, the robot agent. I loved, like, Siegfried and the Claw, who was of the Claw fame. And Agent 13, who was, like, always in a filing cabinet or, like...
Yes.
You know,
yes.
Like, I mean, just... And all those wonderful, like, Don Adams' wonderful lines, not just which we just heard, the Would You Believe, but that he's that classic, missed it by that much, or, you know, and the cone of silence. I mean, this show, the thing you kind of, I guess, remember about shows like these are the degree to which they kind of write themselves into the kind of conversational narrative. It's why I think, like, if you talk to someone like Catherine Tate, she talks about why catchphrases are really important in her comedy, because they give school kids kind of conversational armor in the schoolyard to play with. And I think that's as well. I mean, I don't actually ever remember playing Get Smart as a kid, but I feel like the cone of silence, the shoe phone,
absolutely,
you know, all of that somehow just informed everything as a kid. The cone of silence is still a running gag in my life. So for that alone, I mean, this is a masterpiece. Mm.
I mean, for me, I do, it is the same as you, Michael. It lived on in repeats of a weekend. And it's all you ever watched, like, on, you know, Sunday or Sunday afternoon TV was Get Smart. But for me, the great gift of Get Smart is that it was, especially the first episode was co-created by Mel Brooks, which allowed him to then write The Producers, which then meant he could go on to write Blazing Saddles and my personal favourite, Spaceballs. So without Get Smart, there would be no Spaceballs. And so for me, that is the great gift that Don Adams and Get Smart has given to the world.
It is wonderful.
Okay, team, let's move on to our second round of Game Time. Kylie, Michael, on your buzzers. My name is Sam Tyler. I had an accident and I woke up...
Buzz.
Michael!
Oh, my God. No, Life on Mars.
Yes,
I was going to say Life on Mars. Life on Mars. Thank God for that.
Well, I never watched that.
Oh, didn't you? Oh,
a
my
good
God.
Good show, yeah.
No.
God, hits his head. Hits his head after a motorcycle accident and wakes up in the 60s.
Mm. Yeah, it does.
It's really meant to be really good.
Yeah.
Amazing show.
BBC show. Starred John Sim as a police officer, and he was just... I could watch anything John Sim is in, basically.
He's really good.
Read the phone
really
book, good. I'll turn up. Okay, next one. I reckon this is going to be a tricky one. If either of you get this, this really big ups your bonus points. In an attempt to crack down on crime, the police department has created an elite new team, a team that speaks the language of the streets, young, hip, in touch with the now generation.
Oh, biz. Yeah. I don't want to say 21 Jump Street.
No.
Oh, no. No, that was so 21 Jump Street.
Is it Mod Squad?
Oh.
No, but you've got one word is in common with the actual title of this show.
So I'm going to go squad.
Something squad.
Squad.
It's Australian.
Australian. I know. Australian Funky Squad.
Yes.
Oh, my God. Right.
That's a show that lives in infamy.
I I quite enjoyed it when it was on, but then again.
Look, you might have enjoyed it while it was on. I reviewed it while it was on, and it was was the subject of a period of ongoing angst between Australia's television criticism community and the people who made the program. And that's all I'm prepared to go into at this point.
Okay, so we'll all be thankful they moved on to the Hollow Men and Utopia after Funky Squad then. So that was, of course, done by the Working Dog crew, ex-DGN Late Show, etc.
We gave us Frontline, which is the greatest, one of the greatest of all time. But yes, yes.
This is another tricky one. This is your last one. See how we go. Theorising that one could time travel within his own lifetime, Dr. Sam Beckett stepped into a something-something accelerator and vanished. He awoke and found himself trapped in the past. Michael?
I think I've got it. I think I know it. I'm going to go bzzz.
Yeah.
Because, oddly, this isn't my vintage, but I did, I feel like I did like 100 phone interviews with the cast of this show. Is it Quantum Leap?
Yes.
Oh, my God.
There Scott Bakula.
Scott Bakula. I think I spent the first half of the 1990s just doing phone interviews with Scott Bakula.
It did go for years, didn't it? It went for years.
Oh, my God. And you know what? I'll be really brutal. It wasn't even a very good show.
Kylie, you've won.
Oh my God, I won
something. How did
you do
it after my marathon second round? Oh, this game's a rig.
Before we wrap up, let's see what you're both watching. Kylie, what are you doing this week?
I've come to this late, but I've been watching, through my seven-year-old daughter, I've been watching the animated series Adventure Time, which I don't know if you're familiar with it, but it's ostensibly a kid's show, but it's very trippy and very strange, and I quite like it.
What's it about?
It's ostensibly, I'm not sure. It's got a dog who can stretch into all kinds of shapes and a human called Finn. It's sort of post-apocalyptic. And, you know, there's a princess made entirely of sentient bubblegum and there's unicorn rainbows, but it's very strange and very trippy, but it's enjoyable. I'm not really sure what it's about, but it's quite adult, actually.
Michael, are you tripping out on anything this week?
I'm actually, this is so weird. I mean, so essentially this is joyful but tinged with sadness. Mm. By the time people listen to this, obviously they will know that Tim Brooke Taylor, the British comedian, has died. And I took that opportunity to basically take advantage of living in LA with my Goodies DVD on a shelf and my PAL DVD player next to the television, which I swear to God I never use. I think I've used it once in the last 3 years. But I actually hauled out my Goodies DVDs and I sat there and I spent the afternoon watching Tim Brooke Taylor, and it's such a beautiful show. It was made in the UK in the sort of late 70s, early 80s. The weird thing about it is it never really got replayed in the UK, so the Goodies never really became a cultural thing there. But for Australians, because it was part of the ABC's early evening lineup for basically all of the 80s, and that was a sort of set of shows that was like the Goodies, Kenny Everett, Doctor Who, Astro Boy, Monkey. There's a whole bunch of shows that came from there. So I feel like I grew up with Tim Brooke Taylor, Graham Garden and Bill Oddie. I feel like they gave me, you know, Kitten Kong, and they gave me the Venomous Bagpipe Spider, and they gave me Ecky Thump, which is the secret martial art that's native to Lancashire. And I mean, just, you know, it was a beautiful show. It's basically three guys who have no money who are always offering themselves for hire, and essentially the line is we do anything anytime. And the stories were ridiculous and the show was really cheap. The set was threadbare. They were great pioneers of chroma key. It was a green screen, one of the first shows that seemed to constantly use green screen to patch over the problems. And it was lovely. Tim Brooke Taylor's brilliant and they're brilliant together, and it's a sentimental piece of kind of childhood TV.
Yeah, no, when I heard the Tim Brooke Taylor had died. It was a really, really sad moment because, like you, Michael, it was an absolute touchstone of my childhood, and I used to record it on VHS every afternoon on our half-hour videotape that we had. So I used to fit an episode of The Goodies, and that was it. And I used to watch that all the time. For me, what I have actually been watching, apart from Shaun the Sheep, new series of Shaun the Sheep and Frozen the movie, we finally finished season 2 of Succession. We've been sitting on the last 4 episodes since January. I've finally got through the last 2 on the weekend. It is the story, of course, loosely inspired by Rupert Murdoch, and it's about the Roy family, who are media barons, billionaire media barons in the US, and about the sort of family sort of machinations about who gets to take over when. The last scene of season two is magnificent with Jeremy Strong as Kendall Roy, the sort of older son who's kind of dumped on a little bit. Anyway, the last scene's magnificent. Can't wait for season three, which unfortunately has been delayed due to coronavirus, like everything else. So that's me. Guys, thank you so much. Kylie, my God, well done on the quiz.
Very proud.
Very good. Michael, oh, I don't know what to sentence you to besides indoor labour, which you're already doing.
I'm doing a lot of that already.
All right, guys. Thank you so much. Look, everyone, if you like the podcast, you can subscribe to us on iTunes or your favourite podcasting app, and please rate and review us. You can follow Michael on Twitter at Michael Odato. Kylie is at Melbourne Bitter. And myself is at Lou_Roog. You can also read stories by Michael, Kylie, or myself on the mastheads of the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. We'll catch up with you next time on The Televisionaries. The Televisionaries is brought to you by the newsrooms of the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. It's hosted by myself, Louise Rugendyke. It was created and executively produced by Life editor Monique Farmer and Culture editor Matt Burgess. The podcast is produced by LapFan, and our head of audio is Tom McKendrick. The Nine Network is the owner of this podcast and the streaming service Stan.